This is Gary Lactis.
And this is The Beast Must Die.
He's here. And you're listening to Silence, issue 293. Silence.
Yes.
The online downloadable lifestyle comics magazine show, plus films.
plus anything else that we talk about, like sometimes our dinner, our kids, not getting enough sleep, being dads, and watching telly and stuff. So all that too. That's added content.
For my part, talking a lot about how little time I have to actually read comics and how many comics I haven't read, which I'm sick of hearing myself say. And I don't even listen to the podcast. I don't tune into this like comics podcast thinking, oh, I'm going to listen to some people talk about comics, and it's just a man sat in his car talking about how little time he has to read any comics, and he hasn't read any comics. And there we go. But nevertheless, we are here. Yes.
After the guest-studded spectacular of last week, which was a very enjoyable listen. Nice to not hear myself. That was good.
I'm glad you listened. We got good figures for that, I think.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll take that exactly as I should. I'm bringing the show down.
People are like, spare five. Let's go.
Dougie Knobnobs.
I don't think he loves to be called. Yeah, Douglas Noble does not like being called Dougie Knobnobs, but
he's not here.
And I had to consciously stop myself from doing so last week.
And
Kelly Canny Armour was good. I think she was maybe quite added some numbers.
Probably.
Of course, Tom Mortimer.
Yes.
A huge disappointment. I'm sure you'll agree.
An awful man.
Awful, terrible.
The only person that could have been more disappointing would have been if we got Paul John Milne on. Oh, that would have been the only person.
I did try because I wanted someone to really lay into, you know?
Yeah. Like on a real punching bag.
Yeah, I wanted to really, you know, I wanted to really rail on someone and just have that catharsis, you know, and like make myself feel better about myself.
I didn't.
I'm still just a tired man in a car. Yes, you're all right then.
Yeah, not bad. You know. Fine. Really, just listen. I can tell you about an adventure that happened. into the world of comics. Do that.
Oh, yes, please.
So at the weekend, I saw that my local comic shop, Krypton Comics, both with Ks, KK, Krypton Comics of Black Horse Lane, he'd opened up again on a limited basis. He was open on Saturday and Thursdays and Fridays for a few hours as well. Most of the stuff that Gary does is online. He's got a huge kind of mail order thing going on. But he has, as I've mentioned before, some excellent 50p bins. Mm. I was just like, I basically was a complete hero and did lots of heroic things on Friday and Saturday. We had my in-laws over, and it was my mother-in-law's birthday, and I did all sorts of nice cooking, and I even made a cake. My wife was out on Friday night seeing a friend she hadn't seen for ages. So I baked on Friday. I stayed in and baked on Friday night. Of course I stayed in. I mean, you know, that's what. But, it was like I was like some sort of, it was like I was in WandaVision or something. but I mixed it up. I baked and I watched Herzog. So I was living La Vida Loca. But anyway, I was basically, I'd been a good boy. And then on Saturday, when they left, I was like, can I just go to the comic shop? Because I've got about an hour and a quarter and I can get down there and all this stuff. So, yeah, that was good. I went in, had my first proper nose around a 50p bin for the longest time.
Now, this is the place you've taken me to before.
Yes, possibly. Possibly.
Yeah. Buying a load of like ridiculous looking Image and Malibu stuff that looked like it'd be funny.
That's it. So he basically sells kind of comics at but you know, properly graded, you know, and premium priced. So if you want to get like an absolute mint copy of whatever, he's usually got that in, and but it's always at like the top price it will be. So I rarely buy anything new off him. It's almost always just going, but he's got these proper just like 50p, because if anything comes in that is even slightly below a certain grade, it's just like straight into the 50p bins. But what's even better is he doesn't always care about certain things. So like certain things will be like, oh, here's an old 8-ball. Well, stick it in there. So he can find like real gold in there. And over the years, I've got many great things, like, you know, entire runs of Rarebit, Fiend, and Nexus. And I was thinking the other day, I got like a whole bunch of... what was it? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But like lots and lots of like really good long runs of stuff, just like through sort of furtive bin hunting. Anyway, it was great. It was really nice. I mean, I've been loving getting my lawn bombs every month, and I've obviously been doing the little and often purchasing from eBay and all that stuff, you know, to make myself happy. Mm. I do think my tat habit is a bit out of control, but. But then I was like, there's literally nothing else going on really in life.
And you can always just sell it again, you know.
Exactly. And I have been selling stuff as well, which is good. I have been like selling some stuff on eBay. Anyway, it was really nice to just get in though and have just like that sort of furtive hunting. You know, it's not quite the same when you have to go on eBay. Because also there seems to be like there's so few like genuinely excellent bargains to be had there now. There sort of seems to be almost like a minimum level of which people are selling, and it's like, oh, fuck off, I don't want to pay £2.50 for that old issue of Shade. I want to find it for 50p.
It's the postage, isn't it, that always makes it like not worth it, really.
Yeah It's when someone's like, oh, it's £2.50 and then it's £2.95 postage. You're like, right, okay, so that's basically £5 for one comic. That's shit, thank you. I was in the shop and having a nose round. It was lovely. Anyway, it was lovely, and I got some treats. But some of those treats I'll talk about, so I won't won't wang on about them now. But just the physical experience of being in a shop and listening to Gary and his mate burbling away in the background, and a bit of like, he usually has like Radio 4 or sort of talk radio or something on as well, and it's all very old school comic shop. And I was just really happy. Really, really happy. Nice to be in a, you know, in the physical proximity of a whole bunch of dusty old comics, basically. So that was like my adventure into the real world of comics. Comics IRL, as I like to call it, in my new section.
That's lovely. That's a lovely section.
So there you go.
Adventure involves, of course, the big news is that Marvel is no longer using Diamond. It's going to stop its contract with Diamond distribution. And so I've put in an offer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I've got my car, as you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to call myself Specific House. Chaffinch Specific House. At the moment, it looks like they're going to Penguin Random House, but I'm gonna do better than them. I've got a car. I can do Dave's once a week, probably once a fortnight. And I thought you could do London.
Yeah, I don't have a car, so it might be a bit difficult.
Well, but you know, London transport's brilliant, isn't it?
That's true, and actually.
It's just like every week, it's only about half a ton of comics. And you can you just pop round on your underground tube. And,
I guess I could get
and your,
sort of
and
one
your
of those...
London black cabs. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've got the greatest underground in the world, so I think you're right, actually.
Are you up
just
for that?
Just pop round. I don't want to say no. I don't want to say no. So yes, I'll say yes.
Well, that's good. That's good. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm doing the South. I'll do Dave's. So if you do all of London, and whilst you're there, you could probably go further north, couldn't you? You could probably take, you know, the north and Scotland. You up for that? A Northern Ireland. Not Scotland.
Not up for Scotland, no.
Oh, should we get... We'll get a Logical Volume to do that.
We'll get one of the Scottish Mindless to get on that. Mr. Attack or a Logical Volume or Botswana Beast. We'll just get them on the case.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll do that. We don't know any... we haven't got an Irish Mindless, have we? I mean, I've got some distant cousins over there. I guess I could see if they were up for helping us.
Well, they're all Celtic, aren't they? So, like, that Scottish... The Scottish Mindless can do that.
That's true.
It's just a little boat ride, isn't it? That's all right.
Bobsy, no, I was going to say he's got the West Country connection. I'm just thinking about Wales now. Think about Wales. I mean, does Wales need comics? I don't know if it does. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But anyway, so, I mean, yeah, that's, I'm glad you're on board.
Certainly keep me abreast of how things are going.
I'll phone Stan Lee or whoever it is I need to phone, and I'll sort that out. Nice one.
Okay. It should be good. That'll be just some nice pocket money for you, I think. A nice little side earner, won't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously. Obviously, you'll be working for me. And
yeah,
I'll,
sure. So minimum wage.
Yeah, I'll be taking most minimum. Yeah, maybe a bit less, but...
Okay,
You know, we'll see how it works out. Or? It's a startup, you know. You've got to be on board to... make the cheese board.
Yeah, true.
If you know what I mean.
I do exactly know what you mean.
Good.
I guess I could also... I could get the comics at a discount from my own comics at a discount. Would that be something that that would be okay if I got a bit of a discount?
Well, I mean, initially, I think full price, maybe a bit over full price, just to get those wheels turning. But yeah, eventually, like maybe you could I'll allow you to read one free page of one comic per week, something like that.
Okay, all right, that sounds good. Yeah,
it does sound, it's free, right. It's free. Free page of a comic.
Yeah.
Great, so that's that news tackled. Have we got, is there anything else?
No.
I mean, apart from the usual, you know, we've released another Dan and Fraser's Starlight Adventures, which was great. Actually, things are really hotting up in the world of Star Rider. That's our Patreon only C Unit exclusive podcast in which we read through. An adventure game book for girls from the 80s.
We also answer, if you are a Patreon subscriber and you are interested in the process or anything to do with the books themselves, you can ask us a question. We'll answer it on that podcast, but only if you're a Patreon subscriber, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to hear them, so you wouldn't be able to ask any questions anyway. But just say you tried, it wouldn't work. You have to pay. And then you can ask us whatever you like, as long as it's about Star Riders and our playing of Star Riders.
Yes. And it can be for as little as $1 a month.
It's basically better than this podcast.
It's a lot more fun. Yeah. And it's not just talking about blooming comics again.
Absolutely.
Blooming comics,
more like.
Yes, as I would say. And I think one episode I should be a Brit written by an American for an entire episode. I think we both should. That'd be good.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. All mate. Like loads of flipping blimey. Cool. Mate, Laura laughs. That's Cilla Black, isn't it?
Well, we could be Cilla Black for an episode.
Let's do that as well.
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe
it'd be good if that's what Blackest Night was about. All the characters sort of turned into Cilla Black.
Yes, Blackest Night. Laura Deaths.
Let's see how you got on.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, I think we should have a thing with Patreon where if someone pays, like, you know, a premium amount of like 100 quid a month or whatever, they can just tell us who they want us to be for the entire episode of Silence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just be like, if you pay big money, you just say, yeah, you have to do it as two finishing school girls from the 1920s or whatever, you know, and we'll do it. We've got no pride.
Yeah, I'll do that for £100 a week in perpetuity. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Anything else? No, not really. Other than probably lots, which will come up once we're in the review universe, I expect, having not prepared sufficiently for this recording. You may be surprised to hear how unusual.
Let's do it.
Come with us to review universe with Gary and the Beast and you, of course. And here we are in the wonderful review universe.
Inside the glistening cave.
Yes. Shall I talk about the thing that I read?
Well, yeah.
I think it was Jonathan Sapsed, top Silence listener, Jonathan Sapsed, got in touch. Although I think recently he was working on getting through about 6 months worth. So maybe he's caught up and maybe he is listening fairly contemporaneously. But he, or someone else, mentioned a comic called The Union, which is a British comic, like a Marvel comic set in Britain, a British team. And I used to really like that sort of thing. I used to really like Captain Britain. There was a real sort of a real thrill from seeing, like, an Excalibur, you know, you've got that. Oh, I forget what their name is. The special executive, is it? No.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're hiding. Their headquarters are on, like, the old Brighton Pier, the old crumbling pier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was exciting. And you'd see Bobbies and Bobbies on the beat.
Yeah,
and all
beef
of these things
everywhere.
Yes, and it just made as a child it made the idea of superheroes sort of as just that bit more graspable, rather than being in this sort of far off land of New York or, you know, or wherever, America generally.
America.
So I thought, oh, I'll give this a go. I haven't read a superhero comic in a while, really. Certainly not a modern one since COVID stopped sponsorship. So I thought I'd give it a go, and it's written by Paul Grist, which is a treat. I thought, oh, I really like Paul Grist. Jack Staff, Kane, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a fantastic artist.
Oh, he's one of the very best British comic artists ever, I think.
Yeah,
he's brilliant. He's sort of. He's like Mike Mignola, but more alive and more cartoony and more sort of, yeah. He hit a sort of sweet spot around the, I don't know, sort of the black and white era of Jack Staff, where I just absolutely loved that. I think that's a phenomenal bit of work, and I enjoyed other things like Mudman and stuff. And Jack Staff sort of waned a little bit when it kind of went colour and carried on, and I think he got a bit bored of it, actually, possibly. But yeah, all really good.
I think he wasn't making enough money out of it.
No, and that's sad as well, because he is really, really good. And obviously he did he drew Saint Swithin's Day by Grant Morrison, which is means that he gets a pass for life in this house.
That quite idiosyncratic style, very, very stylish, very good style. So of course he's not drawing it.
No.
Why would Marvel want someone like that doing it? They've got a, you know, they've got a perfectly perfectly competent superhero style artist called Andrea DeVito.
Mm.
Doing pencils.
Yeah, I'm just having a look at it now.
Yeah. It's fine, you know, whatever. Sort of looks like everything else. So issue one, we've got the introduction of the Union, who have been sort of put together, and they're helmed by this character Britannia, who apparently she's introduced as sort of like a legacy character, even though she isn't. That sort of thing. And spoilers, she gets swiftly killed. And Union Jack is there, and he sort of ends up sort of presiding over things. And the idea is you've got a team from each country in the Union. You've got Kelpie from Scotland, who's sort of got watery powers. The Choir, who represents Wales. a voice that can shatter stone.
That's really funny.
Snakes represents Northern Ireland. And there's Union Jack. Now, Britannia swiftly gets killed. Union Jack sort of takes over. England is represented by a little guy called Bulldog, who's a bit of a dick. And they sort of... It sort of immediately turns into this story of, like, a shattered team who have divorced themselves from their sort of their corporate management. It's all compromised by the fact it starts off as part of a sort of cross title event, yes.
Oh, bloody hell.
Called The King in Black, which is the god of the symbiotes, has broken out of prison and makes the sky go black and is turning everyone into Venom types. And then it turns out... I haven't read all the issues yet. I think I've read three or four of them. And then the members are scattered, and Union Jack, I think, is trying to sort of track them down. And there's something hunting them down and killing them and blah, blah, blah. It's like... It aspires to be the sort of story you'd get from a property that had been going a long time and but sort of drops you right in it. And I really didn't like it. I didn't care about anyone. I'm happy for Paul Grist if it's what he wants to do, and I hope he's getting paid nicely. But it seems to me he's created a bunch of characters here that he will have no ownership of. And so there's that, you know. It's just another superhero comic.
Yeah.
That I didn't care about anyone involved. And it's not drawn by him. Perhaps if this was drawn by him, I would feel differently. In fact, I'd definitely feel differently. But it's not. It's drawn by this, you know, perfectly competent, perfectly fine superhero artist. And then there's this... I mean, it's just a difficult thing. You've got a super team that represents the Union, and I guess you've got the... you got that meta thing of, like, you know, they're not really... They are not united. And in the way that, you know...
We aren't.
Yeah, that the UK isn't. But it doesn't... Apart from that sort of... That metaphor, it doesn't really say anything else about it. Because it's a superhero comic. It's Marvel. It's not going to get too political. It's not going to get into it. That's also kind of not Paul Grist's thing. From that perspective, it seems like a bit of a wasted opportunity. It's sort of like what is this? You know, like what is Great Britain? What is the UK really? What is its identity? Ooh. And I can't answer that. And this comic doesn't really know what it is, or doesn't really seem to really represent anything. But you know, apart from like the slight novelty of seeing, sort of suburban Britain, these various settings around Britain. I just really didn't think it had much going for it.
That's a real shame as well.
It is.
You know, like you say, he's such an idiosyncratic artist, and his work, one of the things I loved about Jack Staff was the way he conceived of a whole, not just a whole sort of British superhero universe, with some sort of nice analogue versions of things, or things that were reminiscent of other stuff. But it was also like, it wasn't just comics. He sort of had the whole, he was bringing in the whole Avengers, Doctor Who, tea time mystery vibes. And it just had this lovely, like, it felt like a really, like, coherent other universe of comics and TV and stuff that, you know, you were just coming across. And it was lovely. I would... If I heard about this and I thought, that sounds interesting. Hearing you talk about it and just looking at like the way it looks, it's like, yeah, there's nothing about that that would make me pick it up if I saw it in a shop.
Yeah, for a start, you know, it's been hobbled. It's been hobbled by the lack of his art, and it has been hobbled by having
even an artist with a bit of character. You know,
sure,
it doesn't have to be his art, but it's like it's literally just generic. Sort of modern superhero comics 101, isn't it? It really is.
I mean, you know, it's like if you make your brain squint, you can sort of see bits of Paul Grist in there, you know, in terms of sort of in page layouts, pacing.
Well, I wonder if he sent him, maybe he breaks stories down a bit, you know, like Morrison does. I can imagine as a writer artist, you probably find it quite easy to sort of go, oh, the page sort of looks like this. He's got concept.
I think more likely you'd find it quite hard to go, panel one, and write a huge description of it.
Alan Moore-esque kind of description of everything that's going on in that panel. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's easier to just go, something like this. Off you go. But yeah, no, it just seems like a talent that's been hobbled. There was an article about, like, you know, this, 50-something-year-old man gets his dream come true.
60-year-old super fan.
Yeah.
Comic book super fan. But what's funny is it was in, like, I don't know whether he himself just decided to just really push it, but it seems to have gone a few places, this story. It was in, like, it's on, like, the BBC website and stuff like that, I think. But I was just looking it up, and then it took me to burnhamonsea.com, which has got a news section about Highbridge Comics book superfan Paul Grist speaks about landing Marvel dream job. And it's some really bad photos of him gurning and at his drawing desk and holding up a copy of the comic. It's just really funny. It's like really poor photos.
Yeah.
And it's just he kind of goes on about it a bit, and it's just like talks about Jack Staff, and it's like it's a complete non-story. But previous article, new Somerset Coastal Walks app launches this week, features Burnham and Breen. And the next article is new Burnham on Sea shop opened selling West Country food and gifts. So it's that level of story. Burnhamonsea.com. But somehow it ended up at, like, you know, national news. Yeah. And I guess it's just like, it's a bit like...
He doesn't mind. He's just trying to.
Oh, sure.
Playing the game and like. He wants people to read his comic.
But it's just funny that it's sort of. They've obviously had to try and find an angle. So they're like, oh, he's a 60-year-old super fan. It's like, well, I mean, he's more a sort of 30 to 40 yeah. year comic
a well regarded creator creates yeah
gets the, a job
the story
Marvel.
Is well regarded and talented creator creates something mediocre for corporation
yeah and it's like he has written from before in 1996 he wrote something called the Daily Bugle for them and he pitched a Union Jack miniseries to them which became Jack Staff. So it's just like, it's not really like a story, is it? It's just, yeah, it's funny. Anyway, but good on him for getting some paid work. I hope it pays him more than...
I hope he gets more work, you know. It was a perfectly fine superhero comic, you know.
He says he's bringing back Kane and it's coming out through Image. So there you go. That's good news because Mudman seems to just have didn't get beyond about four issues, I don't think. I think he was like, oh, actually. Sounds disappointing and a bit rubbish.
Yeah. I think I'm just down on superheroes in general, really.
Yeah.
Having, you know... there's been these two opposing forces in my head. You've had Super Gods and you've got Alan Moore. You've got Grant Morrison's Super Gods and Alan Moore's you cannot avoid the fact that these properties are based on exploitation, on the exploitation of talent to a ridiculous degree, you know, in very few other mediums would you have people who have so little payback or even credit, really, for their creations that have gone on to make millions and millions, you know. Mm. These creators have seen nothing. And reading the Stan Lee thing recently was just like... it was just a sort of it was a kind of a sad life, and I don't know. I've sort of come down on the side of Mr. Moore. Really, when I read these things at the moment, they just sort of reek of abused talent. Really?
Oh yeah, I think superheroes are they use people up. They use up these bodies and spit them out. Mm. And they're not. I mean, like I think constantly about the end of Lex Mentallo, which is, you know, still one of the best sort of philosophical treatises on superheroes and superhero comics, and just a fantastic bit of work. But the end where, you know, the sort of conflation of potentially the guy dying and this arrival of the superheroes into reality, signaled with this beautiful full page moment of just explosive kind of like, oh shit, from Frank Quitely. And I just thought, well, he was right, you know, that we were, our reality was invaded by superheroes. Morrison, but it's just fucking ruined everything. They're just a horrible corporate cancer, basically, on everything. Everything is just, you know.
You said on WhatsApp when I sort of mentioned this that they're like, they're demons. They're not super gods, they're demons.
Right, yeah, they are. And I it was funny because you'd been listening to that Stan Lee thing, and I'd been reading Poison Chalice, which was the book all about... It's essentially a book-length essay all about the tortured history of, you know, legal history of Marvel Man, a.k.a. Miracle Man, from his origins as a Well, it talks about essentially how, you know, Shazam was created by, well, Captain Marvel was created by Fawcett Comics, and they were sued. Captain Marvel actually outsold Superman for a while, and arguably the comics were better for a long time as well. And then they, you know, he was sued for being too much of an infringement on Superman, because early on in the kind of genesis of these, you know, any super character that had bore a passing resemblance was liable to be sort of sued. So he then, you know, Captain Marvel eventually ended up being sort of owned by DC, but he has been called Shazam for a long time and all this stuff. Anyway, Marvel Man was obviously, British Marvel Man comics were a shoddy rip-off originally of Captain Marvel. You know, everything was just Captain Marvel. So it was all built on this really strange sort of legal, like dodgy house of cards, really, of legality. But then obviously the whole, when Des Skin started publishing Warrior, he had a sort of verbal agreement from Mick Anglo, who was the British Marvel Man owner, creator. But obviously there was a whole bunch of other stuff going on, and you know, they, anyway, it's basically, it ends up, you know, everyone who had anything to do with this character has just fallen out with each other. He's a kind of cursed superhero, really. So you've got, you know, I didn't realize that Alan Davis, one of the reasons that Alan Davis and Alan Moore are are not on speaking terms is because of Marvel Man. Because when he was created, the British, you know, the Warrior version, there was like, the rights went three ways. It was like a third of it was Des Skin, a third of it was Alan Moore, and a third of it was Gary Leach. And Gary Leach stopped drawing it, and so they then, Alan Davis picked up, and he kind of picked up a similar sort of rights to, so Gary Leach still had a percentage rights, but you know, Alan Davis then got his share, so he kind of owned it as well. And when they started getting published by Eclipse, Alan Davis was in dispute with, I think, Des Skin about something or other, and basically said, didn't give permission for them to reprint his work, and they just went ahead and did it. So he saw that as a betrayal, and him and Alan Moore fell out, and he sort of, they are weirdly, because, you know, Moore and Davis actually for a while were like, they were really like that. They were the collaborators. So you had, you know, them on Marvel Man and
DR and Quinch.
And it's like, actually they were sort of, you know, the team for a while. And so, yeah, that they're not friends anymore. And Des Skin has obviously fallen out with Alan Moore. The Eclipse thing went to shit. They went bankrupt. People didn't get paid. You know, they ended up giving the rights back. Then Alan Moore just said, I just washed my hands of it. And Neil Gaiman, of course, who was due to take over and did take over for a bit with the Eclipse run, he ended up with the rights. Him and Mark Buckingham ended up with the rights. So, and then they, you know, they were in dispute. Then Todd McFarlane apparently buys the rights because they're auctioned off as part of the Eclipse sale. And then him and Neil Gaiman get into it about various things, including the creation of Angela, that rubbish character that was in Spawn, that Neil Gaiman wrote. And it's just goes on and on. It's still cursed now. Like, Marvel bought the rights for, like, you know, billions or whatever, made fuck all because they made such a hash of reprinting it. And you know, notionally, Gaiman is still going to produce these final issues, apparently, but it seems to be stuck in limbo. But it was just really weird. I was just like, it's so odd. It's like Miracle Man, the 80s Miracle Man, Marvel Man, as was, is one of the core sort of revisionist texts, or superhero revisionist texts. It's the less known of them, but it is really, really important in how much it impacted things. And yet it's just also this totally toxic IP and this sort of horrible, destructive thing about, you know, that with ultimate power becomes, you know, power corrupts absolutely. So it's got this really horrible sort of weird resonance for, like, what's going on in the strip and what's going on in real world. And it just made me just go, oh yeah, these things are fucking cursed, aren't they? They're just these really, like, malignant forces that just eat up people's lives and creativity and then continue on immortally.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not. Weird. It's not comics. It's superheroes specifically.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, it's not comics. Yeah, yeah. It's superheroes specifically. Yeah,
yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, it was interesting that you were sort of like, and I thought about kind of getting the audiobook of that Stan Lee book, and then you were like, you seemed kind of bummed out by it, and then I just thought, I don't think I want to put myself through that. Actually, I don't think I, you know, just sort of muck reiki, you know. He wasn't really a genius. It's like, well, I already know that. I already know he was a shyster and he did some dodgy things. But I don't know if I want to, you know, listen to 700 pages of someone dismantling a reputation.
Yeah. I don't know. It was also this, I think, as I mentioned last week, like doing this commission, like where I had to draw, a bunch of DC characters. And I was initially like, oh, I get to draw superheroes. And I started drawing them and it was just... Oh, it's just what? Like, you only actually draw these bloody things. And you're like, this is ridiculous. This is stupid. Like, yeah. Oh, man. It just, yeah. The whole experience bummed me out. I never want to draw superhero comics, ever. There we go.
I've got here's a really hot swerve. This is a great link. So, from talking about rubbish fictional superhumans, I'm going to talk about a real life superhuman. No, that's incredibly cheesy. But
this is your life with me.
Yeah. No. I read something which I had been sort of meaning to read for a long time and never got round to, which is Al Davison's The Spiral Cage. Mm-hmm. So this was published in, I think, 1987 or something like that, 1987, 1988, around that time. And I remember when the kind of influx of graphic novels into like W.H. Smith's arrived, and I got all, you know, you get all these exciting Batman comics and all these, you know, Watchmen was there and all these things. I remember, like, Spiral Cage was there because I guess Titan, you know.
It was 1990, by the way.
Was it 1990?
Yeah, that's when the Titan edition came out.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I remember seeing it and kind of picking it up and looking at it going, I don't know what this is. This doesn't seem like I'm a bit scared of this, basically. I was always very drawn to it, and I've met Al in real life. You know, I've shared a bit of conference space with him. I went to what was it called? The thing that used to be an Ox something panel. Anyway, it was an Oxford based Comic-Con thing. Sort of wasn't really a Comic-Con; it was more of a symposium. But anyway, he was there. I met him. He's a nice guy. I've seen him at a few things. And I've just known his work since, and I've seen, you know, and I've always been, you know, impressed by it. But I'd never actually read The Spiral Cage, and I got this cheap and read it recently, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. So it's an autobiography of, so Al Davison was born with spina bifida, and he has kind of overcome a fair amount of, well, he was born in you know, in the time where having something like that when you were little would mean you could quite easily be written off by the systems within society that were in place. So, you know, it was a much less enlightened time, I guess. He was born at a time where that was almost a death sentence, basically, for him, spina bifida. And it's largely about him sort of overcoming the limitations that his body has placed on him. And he becomes like a martial artist, and he's obviously a comic artist. And it talks about his burgeoning relationships, his kind of fighting back against the various forms of bullying he's experienced in his life. But it's not done in some cheesy, like, triumphant movie of the week way. It's all framed in a very direct and honest depiction of his own sort of mental state and his own struggles and stuff. But it is fundamentally an extremely uplifting bit of work. And what I really liked about it was that I really felt that this is, you can sort of feel him exploring how to tell the story within the medium. And so there's, it's not like a straight kind of story. There'll be like 2-page dream sequences or a set of notes with some sort of scribbly drawings or some really beautifully rendered sort of kinetic imagery of him like practicing his martial arts or something like that. And he's a really fantastic draftsman, isn't he? I mean, his actual his actual work is
you flick through the book and there are a lot of different stuff. I mean, it's sort of, you can see his style.
Yes.
But you can see it's almost like he's throughout the thing he's
trying
still,
out stuff.
He's like, oh, I'm going to do some stippling here, or it looks like he's changing his brushes and pens at different points for different pages and different sections, but he keeps it to sort of different sections, so it's not too jarring. I mean, if you when you're reading it, it works. If you're flicking through it, you're a bit like, oh, this looks like, you know, someone learning, and kind of both is true.
Yes. You know?
But no, it definitely works as a piece, and definitely I had a little. I didn't read through the whole thing today, but I revisited it for the first time in like 30 years today, sort of in preparation. And as a fucking, you know, whatever, 14-year-old, 15-year-old or whatever it was when I first read it, it's a lot more powerful now.
When absolutely.
You know, also being a father, and he's talking about, you know, just in those first few pages about, you know, they didn't think he'd live, and then they didn't think he'd walk, and then they said I shouldn't live. It's like, well, fucking hell, man. Jesus Christ.
It hit really hard. I mean, you know, I've got a daughter who's got like a medical condition, ongoing medical condition, and she's, you know, her beginning was not easy. You know, it wasn't a good time. It was hard, and it was that bit kind of really hit hard when I was reading it, and I was quite like, you know, it made me immediately warm to it, I think, because of the sort of direct way with which he was addressing it. It's kind of direct but poetic. I don't want to give this idea that it's like, you know, Harvey Pekar. It's definitely, because he's a, you know, he's a Buddhist, and he's obviously into like kind of various meditative stuff, so he's not beyond the odd sort of purple psychedelic sort of flights of fancy and stuff.
Yeah,
but that kind of works.
It is of its time. It is comics aren't for kids anymore. I'm going to write a lot of words here, and but he does it well, and the whole thing is very fluid as well.
It's really fluid, and also what I liked is I liked the fact that, you know, it's
almost dreamlike, you know,
in the
way
the
it all sort of just
is,
it's not like, and now it's this scene and now it's this scene. They all, everything sort of smooths together.
It jumps around in time, and it doesn't kind of signpost when things are going to change. It's just all it's really effective, and the art, whilst it's sort of, as you say, you can sort of see it's not overworked, but it's from a time when that sort of like you say, stippling and cross hatching and all that stuff was very, you know, there was a lot of kind of attempts to create texture and stuff with your inks.
But use fine art and illustration just to get away from the, you know, the necessary stylization of superhero comics that had become synonymous with comics, and you know, and it was like, Dave McKean was something to be aspired to, and there's a touch of that here, and there's a certain amount of photo montage and stuff.
And he's it's funny because I sort of thought that first of all, like a couple of points. It really reminds me of some of your earlier work, actually. There's some of the, I don't know, like some of the strips that kind of look like some of the points that when you were, I don't know, trying out your kind of one man anthology stuff, more head comics-y than your current stuff, really. And just occasionally I was sort of looking at some of these pages thinking, yeah, it's not a million miles away from what you were doing, actually. And that was nice. So it sort of gave me a nice, there's a certain sort of nostalgia for a point at which this was someone experimenting with the form, and yet, like, to modern audiences, they might look a bit like people are so fucking confident now. People have been to illustration, comic illustration, like, done degrees in comic illustration, and there's a whole confluence of methods and influences that people bring. Like, this, to me, the Spiral Cage is, like, a really influential comic that possibly people don't realize they've been influenced by, because there is a ton of this stuff out there now, especially in small press, but you know, not even small press, you know, a lot of the, like, some of the bigger, you know, Top Shelf and people like that, they publish these things which are sort of autobiographical works that use various techniques to make it kind of slightly more interesting, be that, you know, a style of cartooning or a slightly metaphorical or allegorical approach or whatever. And I was like, this is really, like,
yeah,
it's really ahead
Catherine
of its time.
Catherine Briggs is Triskelion, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That. Yeah, I think Catherine Briggs is, like, a really good shout, actually. I think she brings a similar sort of level of fine art and sort of page construction and experimental storytelling, but just in general, I think that sort of heady autobio comics is really in vogue. I mean, it's just everyone is doing that, and this feels almost like an urtext, actually, and it's nice because it's not that sort of self-absorbed, nihilistic, slightly self-loathing stuff that, you know, the Canadian school, let's just call it.
Well, this was published properly in inverted commas, and so much of what of this autobiographical stuff, you know, and I include myself in this, is sort of hampered by the confines of the actual time available to do something like that, and this. Al Davison in this is completely, he's like, no, this is going to take as long as it takes for me to be, and for me to do this as best as I can to my abilities. And through, like, at no point do you feel like he's slacking off here. You know, he's, you can see the effort.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you do appreciate that when you're looking at it. And when you're reading at it, that's what I like to do: read at things.
Read at it, yeah. There's a really brilliant bit where, quite early on in the book, he talks about how he's, because he also sort of suffers from ME. He's quite an early on to talk about it, but he's when he has these sort of spells, he loses the ability to walk sometimes, and then also loses his sight. And there's these little bits where he's kind of drawn a full page figure of himself. And it's quite interesting he's quite into his own physical form, naked. And, you know, I think it's a sort of reclamation of his body. And a sort of not like just to say, you know, this is my body and I'm not horrified by it kind of thing. And not that he should be. You know, I'm just saying it feels like he's someone who's been told his whole life that he's a, you know, he's a monster or he's deformed just because he's kind of got these, you know, what he calls scarecrow legs through the spina bifida, tons of scars on, you know, from countless operations.
Yeah, but I mean, man, his torso, he is cut.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, he's a buff dude.
Yeah, I'd love that torso.
Oh yeah, but anyway, there's a nice like full page picture of this, and he's talking about this, and in the background, he's got the actual diary entries. And his own attempts, one of his kind of meditative things he does when he loses his sight is to just try and draw self-portraits. And then he kind of looks at them afterwards to see how close he got to doing his face. And he's got these self-portraits in behind him, along with the diary entries talking about, you know, what he actually is going through as it's happening. And that's just like a great page. It's really, really great. And, you know, that's just a really, like, interesting use of the form and a really heartfelt, sort of open, experiential page of comics that gets you into someone's particular, I don't know, like, headspace and reality in a way that's just incredibly effective. Mm. And it's nice when you go, yeah, only comics can do this. You know, it's not to say that someone can't do something similar with film, but this is a particular thing where it's like, this is a comics page, and this is why the medium is exciting, and why it's nice to just try and push what you do with a page and stuff. So yeah, no, I really enjoyed it.
It's also a sort of prime example of how comics are kind of overlooked. Now, it's not something I like to go on about that much. I know a few people who like talk about nothing else about how, you know, and they really want comics to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. You know, what about, you know, cinema? People think, you know, whatever. But I do feel like a thing like this, if Al Davison had produced a book of these things, you know, he'd have been a sort of perennial presence on Radio 4, you know.
Yeah.
He would be someone who is constantly called upon to, you know, to share his experiences. But it was a comic, so it was sort of, it was only ever going to reach so many people, you know.
Yeah.
And so his message, you know, even though it's told like incredibly well, there's kind of a limit on how much influence it's going to have. You know,
yeah.
But a lot of the time, I think that's great about comics. I it's kind of like this podcast. I don't want this podcast to be a fantastically popular podcast. I like our little gang of listeners and how cozy it all is. And I like that about comics a lot of the time. Special, secret, fun.
Mm. No, agreed. Yeah, I'm not.
But when you read something like that, it's sort of a shame, you know.
Well, it sort of feels to me like actually it's the kind of book that should probably be on a school curriculum, really.
Yeah,
for a number of reasons, you know. It's just like for just an interesting depiction of not disability, that's not the word, but you know. An interesting depiction of that, and an interesting autobiography, and an interesting comic. You know, it's there's a range of things, but also
English art, graphic design. It's Buckminster Fuller's University Without Walls. You know, it would be perfect for this educational establishment that unfortunately doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a real treat actually, and a nice. I sort of hadn't been connecting with many comics particularly. I've been buying them, but not really kind of getting, you know, sort of buying more things that I was sort of just wanted to look at and have and stuff. But this was the first thing I had for ages where I'd actually read it and was really engaged by it, basically.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm glad you did that. And I was really happy you mentioned it, actually, and that I sort of dug it out after all these years.
Because I definitely remember you having it and me kind of, again, when we first started hanging out, I was like, oh, Fraser's got all the... Gary Lagster's got all these, like, weird comics. And that was one of the weird comics. I remember sort of looking at your house and stuff and being like, I don't know, you know. It's not
but
like...
it's Titan. It's a Titan edition, so you've got to get it.
Got to get it. That's it. So thankfully, my weird, obsessive, compulsive buying habits led me into some good comics, which is nice. Well, tell me about something else. Tell me.
Oh, speak. Something else. Well, I mean, I don't really have anything else.
If not, I've got more, so I don't mind.
I've been reading Cotton Candy Autopsy, which is kind of heartbreaking. I've not finished it yet, and I'd like to finish the last chapter, which wasn't published as A Beautiful Stories with Ugly Children, before I talk about it. I do too much talking about comics which I haven't finished reading. So let's wait until I've finished some things. And in the meantime, I would like you, seeing as you weren't here last week...
Yes.
Why don't you... Just for a change, dominate an episode.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah, so dominate me, please.
One of the things I picked up at in my bin diving was I got all eight progs of the Summer Offensive, the Grant Morrison, John Smith, and Mark Miller's takeover of 2000 AD, which happened in 1993. Now I do have these already, but I just was kind of like, they're in a box somewhere up in the attic, and I was like, oh, these are like 50p each. It's like £4 basically, and I was like,
it's easier than going in the attic.
Absolutely. Oh, right. My God, it's easier than going in the attic and like moving loads of long boxes around and things in a precarious. No, it was just like, I want to read these again. And I, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's like, I don't mind having them again because I can always just give them to someone else. And it was kind of nice to look at them and go, it's like a mini-series, because it's quite unusual in 2000 AD's history, in that normally they rarely have a self-contained thing where, you know, all of the stories started in Prog 842 and were done, you know, eight progs later. Yeah. And you didn't... Then it was kind of... It was an experiment, really, and it was... Grant Morrison and Mark Miller, when they were in their special super friends, obnoxious super friends mode in the 90s, and they got John Smith involved. But other than that, no other writers, which is kind of amazing. And at the time, I was like, fucking hell, these are my like favourite writers. I mean, I don't think Mark Miller was my favourite writer, but I knew he was... I felt like he was kind of part of... He felt like one of the gang, and he kind of... He wrote in a way that made you feel like he was sort of part of that. And even though I was sort of beginning to already smell the bullshit, I was like, you know, I'll come to it, but he knows how to be entertaining to a degree, you know. But this was called The Summer Offensive. And I remember being disappointed, really, when this kind of came out. I liked some of it, but I was
The dread was bad.
Well, the dread was bad, and also none of the stuff felt like what I wanted, which was the Grant Morrison who was had written Zenith and was writing things like Doom Patrol. And this is pre The Invisibles, really. I mean, Invisibles was 1994, so I think this is kind of around the time of Sebastian O. Hadn't started writing Justice League. We hadn't got like the sort of second iteration of Morrison, but he was obviously... He was beginning to kind of get into that. So he kind of put on this obnoxious 90s persona. And there's some notorious interviews that were done at the time in comic scene and comic world, I think, where him and Miller sort of just really bolshily slagged off everything and everyone. And it was very entertaining. And lots of it has aged incredibly badly in that way that a lot of stuff from the 90s had. And this, in fact, is this Summer Offensive is a product of the 90s like nothing else. It really, for better or worse, it's like, wow. It reminds you of what an incredibly crass decade it was. What a self-assured, crass and sort of, I don't know, like quite sort of shockingly offensive in some ways. In lieu of being like sort of radical and interesting. And a lot of this stuff like, aged really badly, and that goes across culture, not just this. But anyway, the Summer Offensive was conceived as essentially a kind of shot in the arm for 2000 AD by these kind of shitty upstart writers. And they deliberately didn't use any established characters apart from Dredd, because you've got to have Dredd in 2000 AD. And they just created a bunch of new stuff, and they wanted it to have that sort of fizzy, anarchic feel of early 2000 AD. And it was, I think it largely was pretty loathed. There was a lot of stuff that, you know, people didn't like, and nobody in time, nobody sort of seems to speak that fondly of it. So the strips you had were, you know, Judge Dredd, Inferno, which was written by Grant Morrison, involving a bunch of corrupt judges escaping from Titan and sort of essentially just terrorizing Mega City One by flying spaceships full of a horrible thing called the meat virus into Mega City One. It's kind of Judge Dredd conceived as a Dumbo action movie. You know, and I think at a time I hated it because I was so disappointed by this was what Morrison did with Dredd. Now I sort of think he was trying to sort of say, well, you know, John Wagner's been ploughing this particular furrow, and so what's completely different from that is a kind of high concept, big budget, blockbuster version of Judge Dredd. And you know, it is quite shit, but I kind of enjoyed. I got some enjoyment out of reading it that way this time. You then have Big Dave, perhaps the most notorious strip, a sort of anarchic humour strip, beautifully drawn by Steve Parkhouse, about Manchester's hardest man, Big Dave. Basically, Big Dave is a Sun headline come to life, in personified. He's a sort of thuggish working class oik, basically, in a shell suit, and he's like just he's almost like a sort of superhumanly hard lad, really, and it's an incredibly broad strip and incredibly funny in places and really brilliantly drawn by Steve Parkhouse. The cartooning is some of his very best.
Yeah, can you imagine anyone more perfect?
It's wonderful, and it's like rabidly offensive in its attempts to be sort of shocking. There's stuff in it like the endless use of the word "puff" is like, and it's done. It's meant to be, you know, a sort of ironically, because the whole thing is written in this kind of Sun headline tone. So there's all these like, you know, there's all these like really brilliant like moments where in the first Big Dave where he teams up with Terry Waite and goes to fight Saddam Hussein there's just these great bits where you know he's where is it? Sorry, I'm just trying to find. There's a specific bit where he's basically being persuaded to go by John Major to go and sort out Saddam Hussein. And it starts off and it just has this, it's got this Big Dave and then the number 10 with its door kicked in and two bruised and bad policemen outside. And it just says, "Our mate Big Dave has been summoned to Downing Street for urgent talks with easygoing PM John Major. The beast of Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, has flashed his ugly kisser again, and PM John wants our Dave to throttle that mad weasel once and for all!" An exclamation mark. And it's that stuff that's brilliant. Whereas a bit where he will only do it, so he basically is like, he's not moved at all by any of the sort of emotive reasons to sort of help out, but he says, "One, I want a lifetime supply of shell suits, none of your cheap rubbish, mind, just them smart designer things. Two, I want a 3-week holiday in Tenerife for me and my lass. All expenses paid, indoor bog, the lot. And four, I want a bright orange HREG Ford Capri with smart flame effects down the sides, yeah." And then it says, "You tell them, Dave, we know you'll be worth every penny, my son." And it's just, that stuff is genuinely amazing. But yeah, the kind of endless, he's endlessly calling people puffs and I remember reading one of these interviews with Miller and Morrison where they're being all shocking, and I noticed that Miller keeps dropping that word, and I'm sorry I've used it a few times, but I can't really say the P word. I think that people won't understand what I mean. So apologies if it's offended anyone, but yeah, it gets used a lot, and it's obviously meant to be a bit like playing up that horrible oikish kind of tabloid homophobia, where anything even slightly, you know, effeminate or seen as anything less than red-blooded and masculine is accused of being that. But it doesn't sit well, I have to say. Reading it now, I'm like, man, it's just weird to read like 2018 with essentially homophobic slurs.
Yeah.
And there's some, you know, there's some deliberate and caricatured sort of racist stuff in there, but it's all, it's such a weird tone it's trying to strike, because it's just a bit odd. It's like, what is this though? It's sort of, it's lampooning like some headline British oikish faux nationalism. And the interesting thing is, I was like, as I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, they should have brought back Big Dave for a Brexit storyline. Oh my God, it's perfect. Because, you know, yes, Britain has actually got literally 10,000 times more like Big Dave in the last few years. So I was just like, oh, what were they thinking? They'd never do it. Not with the current safe pair of hands approach that they've got. But I'm like, you know, one of the things I liked about this, the Summer Offensive, is that they have
the safe pair of hands gently massaging the
40-year-old.
The 50-year-old. Something metal fan.
Yeah, don't worry, Johnny Alf was back again, don't worry. And you know, like, it is actually kind of great how weird and just offensive and odd it is. So the next strip you got is John Smith's Slaughter Bowl, which is all about a British sort of nebbish total sort of schlubby, downtrodden, victimised Englishman called Stanley Modest, who is accused. It seems to have been set up, framed as a mass murdering psychopath with hundreds of bodies in his house, who ends up on death row. And the only way is he's got a wife who's dying of some, you know, horrible disease and is on life support, and they're going to turn off life support because it costs too much. So in order to pay for her medical bills, he signs up for Slaughter Bowl, which is essentially this dinosaur, souped up armored dinosaur combat race thing. And it's Smith downplaying his usual sort of purple prose and psychedelic body horror, and leaning more into a sort of straight up dumb exploitation action thing, but he can't help but bring in some John Smithy touches, and he's also very good at like this stuff as well. He's very good at action.
Now, who did the art here?
Paul Pert, P-E-A-R-T, Paul Pert. Right. It's sort of quite
muddy,
sketchy,
muddy palette, isn't it? Was it full painted?
It's not.
Some other dinosaur guff.
That was that horrible Dynasty thing that Pat Mills did with Clint Langley doing the art. That was fully painted. No, this is sort of sketchy. I actually know Paul through social media. I believe he maybe has listened to Silence, but I certainly I'm sort of friends with him on Twitter, because I did say to him, "Are you the guy that did Super Slaughter Bowl?" Because I'm a massive fan of that, and he was like, "Yeah, that's me," and I was like, "Oh, sweet." And this is early work by him, and it's kind of sketchy and impressionistic in places. It's sort of pen and ink coloured, you know, with inks. But I actually really like it. I don't know how it's not to everyone's taste, but I think it works quite well. I think the storytelling's pretty good, and when it soups up, ramps up into the actual sort of carnage of the second half of the story. He really has fun with it. But also, I did enjoy the fact that Stanley Modest is from Tunbridge Wells in Kent, which is nice. So that's Slaughter Bowl. You know, it's not the best John Smith thing, but it's definitely pretty good. And you got Really and Truly, which is Grant Morrison, art by Ryan Hughes, letters by Ryan Hughes. Notoriously, Morrison claims he wrote this after coming back from a club and being on ecstasy, and he wrote the whole thing in about 20 minutes, apparently. Perfectly possible. He's being slightly disingenuous, because he's bringing an awful lot of love for the pop culture of his youth into Really and Truly. It's like a psychedelic, whimsical version of something like The Avengers or something, with a load of riffs on beat poetry and cosmic spacemen and bizarro. He brings in some of that, some of the stuff that actually would crop up in The Invisibles, like the House of Fun, which is the CIA's clown-like building that chases the heroines around. It feels like something out of The Invisibles book one, actually. But it's essentially a light and frothy piece of pop art with two completely indistinguishable leads, one white girl, one black girl. They're called Really and Truly, and I think possibly one of the jokes is you never know which one is really and which one's truly. But they're, you know, impeccably stylish sort of wasters who go on a
touch of the Betty Boos about them.
I think, definitely. There's a sort of, it's kind of candy-coloured, drug-fueled, booze-fueled odyssey through a kind of futuristic, pop-cultural, just funscape, really. I was quite disappointed. I could tell that Ryan Hughes' work was great, and I knew what Morrison was doing. I was quite disappointed because I was like, it's so unserious. But again, with a bit of hindsight, it's actually just great. It's really great. It's really fun. It slides along, and it looks beautiful, and it is a kind of sugar rush of a thing, and it's really fun. And then the final strip is Maniac 5, which was Mark Miller's solo joint, with some fantastic Steve Yoel art. He was at the peak of his powers, and it looks great, and it's definitely one of the reasons that I liked Maniac 5. This is Mark Miller, obnoxious jerk-off writer, turned up to a million. It's sort of deliberately, knowingly, appallingly obnoxious, this comic.
Do you know what? I think this was one of the strips that was like, I think maybe I read the first two, and then it was the strip that dropped off. My weekly prog reading.
Right, yeah.
I would rarely read 2000 AD cover to cover.
Right, okay, interesting. I was always like slavishly reading it, whatever, going through the dog shit, even the Michael Fleischer years. But yeah, Maniac 5 is a relentlessly dumb action movie comic about a psychopathic guy called Frank Bullock, who is psychically linked to five robot bodies of increasingly weird and sizes. So you've got Maniac 5 is the sort of humanoid one, this kind of big meathead looking thing with a bandana. Then you've got Maniac 1, who's like a giant sort of mech kind of thing. And Maniac 2 is a little weird kind of bug-like thing. Anyway, he basically body swaps. It's meant to be a sort of, I don't know, like almost like a riff on Thunderbirds or something. And then it's just this really dumb, over-the-top, quasi-satirical action strip. But it's like within it you can see all of the bad things that Mark Miller is going to do laid out in very clear. It's like, if you think this is shit, wait till you read Nemesis, or wait till you read, Wanted or whatever. It's all that kind of turbo obnoxious bullshit that he's been churning out. But, you know, it's also very readable. It does just crack along. It's sort of absurd. And Yoel's art is really nice. But it's
colour.
Yeah, it's coloured. It's called Gina Hart is the colourist who worked on a lot of his stuff. I mean, I do prefer him black and white for sure. But you know, so it's reading it in a one-er, like a mini series.
Did you read it prog to prog?
Yes, I did.
Did you read each story?
I didn't read it as that. I read them prog to prog, but I read them all in one kind of sitting because it's, you know, you can rip through this stuff. And it was just like, did it work? And I was like, there is a similarity to sort of the early days of 2000 AD and maybe action, where it is just a bit more kind of, it's got a more of an exploitation vibe. And I quite like the fact that it's, if you actually sort of break down the strips, because I remember being a bit like, this is so random. They're so random. But actually you go, well, the way it used to be in 2000 AD was there would be a weird humour strip like Captain Klepp or something like that. And that's like Big Dave. And then you'd have a future sports strip, and that's Slaughter Bowl. you'd have your kind of future war, you know, tough guy strips like Rogue Trooper and that's your Maniac Five, and then you've got Really and Truly, which is just, I mean, I guess that's your sort of Halo Jones outlier with you know, your female fronted, slightly less macho strip, of which, you know, your Judge Anderson or your Halo Jones strip. So in some ways I was like, yeah, I guess it's sort of, they were almost trying to mix it up a bit, you know, they were trying to go, yeah, you don't have to just do variations on Rogue Trooper forever, you can do all this stuff, and you know, it is quite shitty. There's a lot of bad stuff, and it's definitely sort of, there's a certain kind of irreverent tossed offness to it all, which I remember being really offended by, because I was like, you know, SAT is important, and you could tell they're just like, ah, mate, we can shit it out, it's easy. But I sort of feel like it wasn't a bad idea to do that, because it was a bit weird, the comic at the time, and it was flailing around. This is around the 800s, and I would say the last time the comic was really genuinely good was probably about Prog 700. So it'd been shit for quite a while. There was a lot of weird stuff in there. The occasional good things, like, you know, might crop up, but it was in a bit of a tailspin, and it was a nice kind of injection of irreverence and fun and oddness. And it, over time, you know, it does read. It is more interesting than probably pulling out another eight progs at random. And I'd quite like this experiment in, you know, like I say, almost like a mini series within the comic. But yeah, fascinating little blip of oddness. And I don't think any of them, I'm sure Miller, Smith and Morrison, none of them would be like, yeah, that's, I'm really proud of that stuff. But, you know, it's all right. I enjoyed it. I had good fun reading it. It was like, that was a good sort of couple of hours on, you know, well, I'd say about an hour of reading.
folly.
Kind of cool. Yeah.
A folly. Yeah. Back to folly.
A definite folly.
Like my, yeah. That's, I'd rather have a folly than.
Absolutely.
You know, just, you need a folly every now and then. Like the rest of 2000 AD, you know, probably since, has been sort of boring pavement. And
yeah, absolutely.
A lot of it has had paving stones that are, you know, sticking out dangerously, and you could trip over them and hurt yourself.
Absolutely. This is a great analogy. It just keeps getting better.
Yeah. And between those paving slabs, there's also a lot of weeds. And I'll tell you what, quite increasingly, people are letting their dogs do a big shit on.
On
that pavement or sidewalk. Sorry, American listeners. Getting rather too Anglocentric.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, man, that took me right back. Mm. I remember when that... I think that was when I just moved out of home, was when that happened.
93. Yeah, I'd say that was probably about right. You moved to Hastings in... I was doing my... A levels, and so yeah, 93, 94.
I
think that would be about then. Because I definitely remember, like when I think back to it, reading at the time, I definitely was quite, you know, I was in quite a happy space, I think. You know, I can put myself into that time and like, yeah, I think I didn't have many worries. Really? I think I probably thought I did, but I don't think I did, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was quite into the summer offensive. It was the first time I remember Esquerra's computer colouring coming into effect. Is that a false memory?
It was too. You know what? I thought it was too. But actually, it's not. It's painted. I think it was just after this. I'll tell you what it was. It was that Dread strip that Wagner wrote, which was kind of like the Cursed Earth 2, which was called Wilderlands. And that was when it first came in. So it was just on the cusp. But it's funny because I had that exact same thought. I was like, oh, yeah, this is where he does all the computer, all those horrible lava effects and stuff like that. But no, it's actually not. And his art actually is really good. Like, I think he's quite enjoying drawing, like, horrendous dumb action. And and the way the figures are all pumped up, I definitely think like Morrison's like, this has got to be like the Image Comics version of Judge Dredd or something. I think you can imagine him sort of being like, we got to play with that, you know, Rob Liefeld. It's going to be like Liefeld's Dredd, because he was really taken by all that Image stuff. I mean, he rinsed it a bit and was kind of... But I think he was
It's already exerted an influence on the size of the shoulder pads, hadn't it?
Absolutely. And it is like, there's a big, you know, Dredd was there first with all the pouches and shoulder pads. I've got to say, you know, he was there first.
Like, yeah. But
the
then,
original
but then
pouch
you,
lord.
And you have something that's already there and then have the outside influence, like, and pump up the things that are already there more. And man, that is a mess. Just the size of those shoulder pads. Oh. I reckon that'll be my dying thought. It's like, man, in the 90s, Dredd's shoulder pads were too big.
It's always bothered me how the eagle works on Dredd's shoulder pads. Like, what is it? Does it restrict the movement at all? You know, like, it sort of sits on the side. It's like a clip that almost sits on the side of your shoulder. And I was always like, in my mind, I could never quite see how he could move his arm so free. I get it with the sort of big old pads.
Is it stitched into the actual to the his leotard that he wears beneath?
I mean, it's a very odd.
It's a leotard
odd
with
uniform,
bits stuck
isn't
on,
it?
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really odd. You know, and when you see like Esquerra's like original thing, he was kind of going for this kind of Baroque conquistador sort of look, and you know, originally Wagner was like, no, I don't like it. It's too frilly and fancy. And he wanted him to look a lot more like, I think his original conception was Frankenstein in Death Race 2000. That sort of, you know, leather and a small sort of weird like helmet. A bit more like a sort of traffic cop, really. Mm. And so you've got this kind of oddly evolving thing where he's become like, there's elements of that original design that are still there, like the eagle and all that stuff and the chains and stuff. But it's become like a sort of simplified iconography that is, and some artists play it down. You get someone like Brendan McCarthy, who really is great at playing it up in the right way, where he can kind of go, yeah, I can make all this shit look great. And then you've got your other artists who are obviously a bit like, trying to bring it, like, I always felt like Cam Kennedy, for example, was trying to bring it a bit more back down to a sort of textured, like, meaty uniform, you know, like leathery uniform with like big clumping boots and stuff. Yeah, it's just interesting. Like,
it's such an odd
design.
He didn't have that sort of that clinging superhero body, like, you know, beneath, which I never liked. Really?
No.
When you had sort of, basically a naked man, spray painted black with lots of yellow big things stapled onto his flesh. you know, that never really worked for me. But, you know, it's nice. There's a Dredd out there for everyone. And there's Siku as well. It's like the the meatball with the helmet.
But
I respect that. I think that's good. He did. Pat Mills was talking about Siku the other day.
Wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. He drew a bit of Slane, but he had to withdraw because he's a minister, isn't he?
And Christian
Christian minister, and he couldn't. He couldn't deal with the pagan stuff, you know, in all good conscience. So he withdrew. fair enough. But yeah, wow, you know, I had just no idea. I don't know what it is, but I never looked at Siku's art and thought, yeah, he's probably a Christian minister. There's something really Christian ministry about his meatball with a helmet look. Of Dredd, you know, it's funny.
Well, I remember seeing him at a conference, some comic event I was at, and I remember like must have been one of those Bristol ones actually that we went to, because I don't think I really went to any others early on, like when I was just going as a punter, you know, not selling my wares. And I just remember looking, and actually his pages looked glorious when they were laid out in front of him. I was like, fucking hell. And I was not really a fan. But no, they were very beautiful when I looked at them, sort of. But he was there, and I do remember he was wearing a suit. And he looked quite sort of, he was a big smiley man. He wasn't big, actually, he was quite little, bald head and stuff. He just looked really like smart. And I remember sort of everyone else just sitting around, like loafing around in their old T-shirts and stuff. And he looked quite smart. So
nice to make an effort.
Absolutely. More people should wear, we should wear suits.
Should we wear a suit for the Thought Bubble this year?
Yeah.
Should
it
happen?
Let's get our wedding suits out and just sit around in those all weekend.
I can just, I don't know what that's going to be like.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
They're going to have sort of a sort of one-way system.
Well, I just,
can you imagine that, like, the usual interminable sitting there whilst people sort of come through looking disinterested. It'll be sort of really regimented, and you'll have one person every 3 seconds who will feel pressure to not stop.
Yeah.
Lest they hold up, this sort of pipe that you're in, form a blockage.
And we won't be able to have what we normally have, which is like our pals coming and standing around the table and sort of talking to us to keep us sane. So that probably won't be able to happen. It might be a bit odd.
Yeah, it's who knows what to expect. But anyway, maybe
we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. I personally would be very surprised if it goes ahead, but I hope it does. You know, for a number of reasons, mainly the main one being for them. You know.
Yes.
But yeah, it'll be odd it not being like Comics Christmas. Which is what it's always been for us, because it will just be a bit like, oh yeah, God, the idea of like even less incentive to stop at the table.
Yeah,
that's a bit.
Maybe comics. It'll be comics. I don't know, Whit Sunday or something.
Yeah,
some other minor uncelebrated holiday.
Yeah,
yeah.
Ash Wednesday.
yeah, comics Ash Wednesday.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, not even Pancake Day. The fucking day after. Can I have a pancake? No.
No, it's the day after. You can have some ashes on your plate.
Yes. Or it might be an orgiastic release of energy.
Yes, 1920s style.
Before the fourth wave, inevitably. I mean, fucking hell, if that fucking cunt goes like, oh, this ease of lockdown will be irreversible. Yeah, whatever. It's definitely happening again.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah,
it's definitely happening again.
Like, I literally was just like, I sort of haven't looked at the news for a while, and I was like, you know, this was the day of everybody going out. I looked at the news, Guardian. That's the news. Indian strain. Scientists very worried about it. I was like, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Can't wait for that. It's just like, there's no good news ever.
Yeah, luckily it's just India, and there's not that many people there, and it's exactly. Not that big, and it doesn't have that much influence in the world.
No. Exactly.
Or importance.
Yeah. Like, no chance that it'll come. It's all right, we're on top of it. We've stopped any travel to India or from India. It's like, yeah, I'm sure that's going to stop that virus coming over then. It's just like, yeah. Hooray! Anyway, whatever. Yeah. People don't come to this podcast to hear us moan about the shittiness of the everyday existence. They come to hear us talk about old comics.
But I kind of think they do. I mean, it's not like... It's not like we talk about that many comics. I listened to House to Astonish the other day, and it's like, yeah, wow. You know, it's like a proper structured thing.
Typically. And they make sure they read new things as well, yeah. Don't they?
You know? Yeah. And you can see that from when we're doing a Silence to Astonish, the way Al sort of, is let's say, much better than us at sorting shit out.
Oh, yeah, he knows who comic creators are.
Yeah.
I've always just like, can we get, can we get, insert 1992 peak creator? yeah. And then find out, oh, yeah, we can. But, I mean, they're in their late 60s now. So, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good job that, you know, it's all just like, yeah, the dear listener can go and listen to any number of other podcasts.
Absolutely.
But, dear listener, thank you for listening to us.
Mm. We're still in the review universe, by
we
way.
Are still in the review universe. We're reviewing other better comics podcasts now.
Critically reviewing ourselves, yeah. Well, have you got anything else, or should we...
No, of course I don't.
All right, let's do it then.
How dare you? Let's go away from the review universe. It was a trip back in time and also had some contemporary shit.
Uplifting too.
And, yeah, absolutely, I'd agree with that. All of everything that was expressed in that beautiful song.
Yes, a beautiful song it was.
Ah, yes, and of course... You can buy, or if you go to Bandcamp, you can buy the album of every single Reviewniverse outro we've ever sung. You can buy that for £4 million.
I wish we had that. That would be like the most horrible, insane thing. And what we should do is we should get them, but they should all play at once, and the album is actually only like 40 seconds long. But yeah. There are over 300... They're 300 tracks compounded into one.
And it's a special, unique file format, which can only be played on a special player, which you then have to shell out more money for. And and that is programmed in a way that it will only allow you to play that one 40-second song on Christmas Day.
whenever the Queen's speech is, it plays then.
yes. There's a special feature that allows it to be played whenever there's a minute's silence after the death of a member of the royal family.
There's been many very funny people on Twitter talking about, you know, royal grief. Not that I'm going to make light of it. I'm not going to make light of it.
I stopped crying to record a podcast last week, but apart from that, it has not stopped.
No.
I have not stopped crying. And neither have you.
Oh, no, God, no. No, the tears have come... plentifully and often.
Anyway,
and,
Jonathan Sapsid said there was far too much royal coverage in the last silence.
We don't want that accusation levelled at this. So
we'll shut up now. Thank you, Jonathan, for keeping us in line.
Absolutely.
Whatever. You fucking heathen. You disrespectful piece of shit, Jonathan Sapsed, telling us not to talk about the death of our wonderful prince. the Duke of Hearts.
The Duke of Hearts, yes. So anything else you want to talk of, speak of?
No, I mean, I'd just like to point out that there are four boxes of unsold comics in my flat, which are, two of them are under the dining room table. They're all right. The cats sort of eat the box, but they haven't actually started to eat the comics yet. It's mostly Daisy the Galacticat. Either doesn't seem so bothered. Daisy really likes a bit of cardboard, just loves chewing away. There's a couple in another cupboard. And, if you want to help, dear listener, then do go to FraserGeeson.com and order some actual physical comics off me. If you don't want to help, Just get them digitally. That'll be fine. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. And I should, why not? I pimp myself. I have moved my online shop onto Big Cartel now. And it's a lot easier to get my all my digital Cindy and Biscuit works. You can still buy physical copies of Sticky Ribs 1 and 2, but I am now officially out of physical copies of any Cindy and Biscuit stuff, and I'm not going to get...
That worked. You had some last time I talked to you, and then you did a little push, and now you don't have any.
A little push, yeah, a little push. But I just, there won't be any for any time soon, because I'm not shelling out loads of money to get a few, to sell a few copies of it. So if you want to read Sydney Biscuit, then you can get the whole gosh darn library for £10, and that's about 300 pages of Cindy and Biscuit, maybe more. It's probably
very good. That's still very good value, even for a digital thing.
Even for old digitals. But yeah, the plans are afoot to do some more Cindy and Biscuit, and it may come back, but it would almost in physical form, but it will probably be in a different form. So yeah, at the moment, if you want them, that's how you can read them. And yes, and so
you can still
buy
Sticky Ribs physically, can't you?
You can, there's still a few of those knocking around, and nice little physical objects they are too. But yeah, so if you go to milkthecat.wordpress.com, go to the shop, and it will take you through to my nice, easy-to-use Big Cartel page. So please do purchase and make yourself happy.
As happy as it's possible to be.
Absolutely.
Or unless you had an original Gary Lecter's pet portrait.
Oh, yeah. How goes the pet portraiture?
I'm doing quite a few. There was a huge run on them. But I've done three or four, which I can't share online till the actual person event they're being bought for's birthdays has happened.
Right.
So... yeah, what I normally do is, like, I share something and people go, that's really good, I want one, here's a picture of my dog. And, look, just don't bother, dear listener, you're listening, that's enough.
Exactly. If you do want a picture of a pet, drawn in an amusing style, then you should get on it.
In a less than likely situation. finally, if you want your pet drawn as a superhero, and I will charge extra for that, and just for the fact that, like, it will feel like a bit of my soul is being removed with every line.
So there you go. If that's not incentive, then I don't know what is.
Yeah. There we go. I'm slightly worried about this lack of love for superheroes. I'm just hoping it comes back at some point. At some point, I can sort of enjoy casually reading a superhero comic. But I don't. That might be it now.
Oh, I tell you.
Apart
what,
from
mate.
Like twisted visions of such things, like something by Paul John Milne or that kind of shit, but even like all that, there's that sort of Jim Rugg, what are those ones that come out from Fantagraphics, the guy with the fists on his thing, these
written by Josh something. I know the ones you mean. We worked with Ben Mara and Jim Rugg. And
Ben Mara, yes.
Yeah, yeah. They're sort of like weird, ironic, mental things. The guy who did it is...
There's too much... They're just really reverential for superhero comics.
Yeah, you need a bit of martial law in you. Read some martial law again, and then that'll make you feel better. Just trying to find. I've got a comic by that guy, and it's really good. He did. That's why I was like, I read this thing that he did, and it's like this kind of really great comic, and then it's like, oh, right, what you really want to do is just bloody fucking superhero comics, is it? Oh, all right, that's annoying, because yeah. I really like him, Josh something.
Sort
oh,
of meta... Yeah, that meta sort of
it's
all about replicating the feeling of the ephemera, you know,
yeah.
of comics rather than, you know, actually telling a good story or something. It's like yeah. it's like the stories are a second place,
yeah,
to just some sort of feeling, and there's something that's very sort of coffee table and cool about it, you know.
Josh Baer, that's
it. The guy,
sorry, because he did this comic called Raw Power, which I fucking love, anyway, I was just like, oh, he's amazing, anything he does I'll be really into, and then it was like, oh, I'm not so into this because I just don't really care about sort of, yeah, like you say, this sort of reverentialness to superheroes, and I don't know. Although I have read the best superhero comic I've been reading. I will talk about it on the next Silence in depth. But trust me when I say that Nth Man, the Ultimate Ninja, is the comic that
I thought you were going to talk about that. But yeah, maybe I'll try and like get that digitally or something. And...
Yeah, just try and read at least a couple of them because it'd be good.
I think it's quite nice to sort of trail. Something we may talk about in the future.
Yeah, yeah, it's good as well if we talk about something we've both read. It definitely helps as well.
Yes.
So yeah, but that has been floating my boat. I've been like, yeah, more of that shit. But yeah, no, I know what you mean. Superheroes. I was just like largely thinking about, you know, the way that recently I was thinking, you know, what I miss is people creating new superheroes. It just doesn't happen. It used to happen all the time. You read old DC and Marvel comics and they'd just be like some new attempt and they didn't always work.
Well, Paul Grist has done that. We're back to the Union. Like, he's done that.
True.
But I'm like...
That's
true. I'm like, why have you done that? I think it's because it's by a creator who I see as an auteur.
Yeah, it's a bit
like, why have you done that? Why have you just shot your load into that void?
Yeah. 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 The void of superheroes. And hey, talking of voids, we will see you back here for the next void experience.
Yes.
When you join us.
Next time.
Here.
On. Silence!
Yeah. Should always end with a shotgun being cocked and fired. Yes! Comics.